these a little bit bigger screen. If you want it later, I've given them permission to distribute it. If you give them your email or whatever that you send out, I have hundreds, plural, of hours of prayer in this. The last time I was here, not for the ordination service, the last time I was here to preach, my wife and I were dealing with some situations in our life and marriage, and Mom Johnson got a word from the Lord, which is not what I wanted. And I wanted the word, I just wanted something different what she gave me. Anybody ever been there? And this is the result of me trying to A, receive, B, implement, and C, change my life. And so I'm going to be very vulnerable tonight. We're going to get in this and we're going to see how far we go. I know you got school. And so if it gets long, we're just going to stop and we'll pick it back up Wednesday night, okay? But out of every message I've ever preached, I think this is the most important one I preach. Not because I'm doing self-gloss. I'm not promoting myself. It's just a very, very important message. And my life's an unfinished song. Sometimes, you know, I know the basic melody, but sometimes I get to parts I don't know the words, so I just gotta hum. And every one of our lives, we're works in progress. We're not what we used to be, but we're really not what we ought to be. And we're somewhere in a process. We're somewhere in a work of progress. Isn't it amazing we want people to extend mercy to us because we're not what we ought to be? But man, we sure demand perfection from others, don't we? And I want you to know your pastor's a work in progress. I want you to know every husband in here is a work in progress. I want you to know every wife in here, every mother in here is a work in process. And every one of our children are a work in process. And so let's be patient with God and be patient with people. Can I get an amen in the house? Go ahead and put that up for me, brother. First text we want to look to. This is my little title page. I'm building today the world I will live in tomorrow. My subtitle is insecurity, having a conscience void of man, void of offense toward God and toward man. Next slide, brother, in our first scripture, if you turn with me to the book of 1 Kings, the 11th chapter. 1 Kings, the 11th chapter. And because I've commandeered the thing, you're going to have to read your Bibles like the old-fashioned way tonight. 1 Kings, the 11th chapter. Feel a wonderful, close touch, intimate touch of the Lord tonight. And I felt Him in prayer today. And some of you, before we're done with this, are really going to have an encounter with yourself. And I'm believing God will help and strengthen all of us. 1 Kings, the 11th chapter, and I want to start reading in verse 28. And the man Jeroboam was a mighty man of valor. And Solomon, seeing that the young man was industrious, he made him a ruler over all the charge of the house of Joseph. And it came to pass at that time when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem, that the prophet Adonijah the Shilonite found him in the way. And he had clad himself with a new garment, and the two were alone in the field. They were all by themselves in the road. And Adonijah caught the new garment that was on him, and he rent it into 12 pieces. And he said unto Jeroboam, take thee 10 pieces, for thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will rend the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon, and I will give thee 10 tribes. I will give 10 tribes unto thee. But he shall have 1 tribe for my servant David's sake and for Jerusalem's sake, the city which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, because they have forsaken me and have worshipped Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Zidianites, and Chemoth, the god of the Moabites, and Milcom, the god of the children of Ammon, and have not walked in my ways to do that which is right in my eyes, and to keep my statutes and my judgments, as did David his father. Howbeit, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand, but I will make him a prince all the days of his life for David, my servant's sake, whom I chose, because he kept my commandments and my statutes. But I will take the kingdom out of his son's hand, and I will give it unto thee even 10 tribes. And unto his son will I give 1 tribe, that David my servant may have a light always before me in Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen to put my name there. And I will take thee, and thou shalt reign according to all thy soul's desires, and shall be king over Israel. And it shall be, if thou wilt hearken unto all that I command thee, and will walk in my ways, and do that which is right in my sight, to keep my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, that I will be with thee, and I will build thee a sure house, as I built for David, and I will give Israel unto thee. And I will for this afflict the seed of David, but not forever. Verse 40. Solomon sought therefore to kill Jeroboam. And Jeroboam arose and fled into Egypt unto Shishak, king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. And skipping down to our second part of our text, 1 Kings, the 12th chapter. We're going to start reading in verse 6. 1 Kings 12 and 6. And King Rehoboam consulted with the old men that stood before Solomon his father while he yet lived, and said, "How do you advise that I may answer this people?" And they spake unto him, saying, "If thou wilt be a servant unto this people this day, and will serve them, and answer them, and speak good words unto them, that they shall be thy servants forever." But he forsook the counsel of the old men which they had given him, and consulted with the young men that were grown up with him, which stood before him. And he said unto them, "What counsel give ye, that we may answer this people, who have spoken unto me, saying, 'Make the yoke which thy father put on us lighter'?" And the young men that were grown up with him spake unto him, saying, "Thus shalt thou speak unto this people, that spoke unto thee, saying, 'Thy father made our yoke heavy, but make it thou lighter unto us.' Thus shalt thou say unto them, 'My little finger shall be thicker than my father's loins.'" Then we want to go to Galatians, the 6th chapter in the New Testament. Galatians, the 6th chapter. We'll start reading in verse 7. Galatians 6 and 7. "Be not deceived, God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. For he that soweth to his flesh shall of his flesh reap corruption. But he that soweth to his spirit shall of the spirit reap life everlasting. And let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we will reap if we faint not." I am building today the world I'm going to live in tomorrow. What a man sows, that will he reap. Whatever kind of a world you're building today, tomorrow you're going to have to live in that world. Decision by decision, nail by nail, board by board, I decide what my tomorrow will look like. My tomorrow is not a chance of happenstance, how secure I am or how insecure I am. I am determining today by how I build my life today. That's why today is such an important day, because however I build today will determine what my world, what my house, what my family, what my life, what my eternity will look like tomorrow. I am building today the world that I will live in tomorrow. And lastly, Acts the 24th chapter, before I let you be seated. Acts the 24th chapter. We want to start reading verse 16. "And herein do I exercise myself, to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men." Can I tell you the greatest struggle of Christianity is not our holiness standards? Those become pretty easy to live after a while. The greatest struggle of Christianity is always having nothing between me and God, and never having anything between me and other people. That is the greatest struggle of Christianity. And Paul said, every day I wake up and I go to the gym and I lift the weights. And I don't want to live my life where I have offense, where I have aught, where there's problems between me and those that live around me. God bless you. You can be seated this evening. Give me the next slide, brother. A clear conscience, like I said, is usually on a bigger board, so some of you may have to strain, but a clear conscience. It matters not at all what people say and what people do when you know you have a right to stand before God. Let the liars lie, let the haters hate, but when I've lived right, when I've done right, it matters not what other people say about me, it matters not what other people do against me, when I have a right standing with God, I'm secure in everything that's in my life. But have you ever noticed those times in your life where maybe you haven't lived completely right? Maybe there's something in your life that you're not doing that you know you ought to do. And isn't it amazing, a trial, a sickness, something comes in your world and you aren't walking boldly before the throne of grace with confidence, knowing that God hears you. You come in trembling, knowing there's something between me and God, and things aren't right. And God, I can't come to you like a child. I've got to come to you and ask for mercy. Would you cover this? Would you hide this? And then please, would you help me? Nothing depletes self-confidence. Nothing depletes my self-worth as living a lie, not living in public, not living in private what I preach in public, insecure before God. But can I tell you, insecurity before God, insecurity before God must also be replicated with insecurity with others. Nothing depletes our self-confidence like when we stand in the presence of others and we know they have the goods on us. How do you tell them you're a preacher when they heard you tell the dirty joke last week? How do you tell them that you're a child of God when you crashed the computer system at the workplace because you were on websites you shouldn't be at? Insecure. Insecure with God. Insecure before others, which makes me insecure with myself. Let the haters hate. Let the gossips gossip. But when I'm living right, it does not matter what hell throws at me. It does not matter what life throws at me. It matters not what others say about me. When I know I'm right with God, I'm right with God. Can I get an amen in the house? A clear conscience requires right and righteous living. Laziness is one of the greatest thieves of self-confidence. Laziness, carnality, and a lack of faith are the only reason God's perfect will not be accomplished in my life. Hell can't stop what heaven has started. If God promised it, it matters not what hell wants to do. It matters not what liars want to do. They can't stop in my life what God has started in my life. But carnality and laziness are the greatest reason I will not become what God has called me to be. Did you know only 2% of the American populace identifies itself as homosexual? But how much preaching do we do against homosexuality? Which is fine. I know it's the driving force of media. I know it's the driving force of the world we live in. But let me tell you, every single man in this room struggles with laziness. Every single mother in this room struggles with laziness. Every single child in this room struggles with laziness. We inherited it from our father Adam. We got it. Part of our DNA genetic is we're all born lazy. We're born lazy. And nothing depletes self-confidence like 20 hours of Facebook and 10 hours of Instagram and 40 hours of Twitter, and you haven't done your job and you haven't done what you were told to do. And as soon as you hear footsteps coming down the hallway, you quickly clip the icon and diminish it and go back and pretend you're working. And you wonder why you're insecure. Who are you stealing from? When you are lazy, who are you stealing from? I know you're stealing from your boss, but ultimately you're stealing from yourself. You know when my self-confidence is through the roof is when I go to work and they give me a job and they say, hey, Lance, I don't think you're going to be able to get this done today. And I square my shoulders and I work through break and I work through my lunch break. And by the end of the day, I walk out the door and it don't matter there's bills that I can't pay at home when I get there. It don't matter that the kids have the flu when I get there. Buddy, I'm on top of the world because I just stepped up to the plate and I knocked it out of the park. But let me goof off all day. And who have I stolen from? Who have I stolen from? Let me play 80 hours of Xbox, Nintendo. Who have I stolen from? Who have I stolen from? I want every man in this room to say my daughter's lazy. I want every woman in this room to say, my son is lazy. I know that's harder for you to say, but your son is lazy. And if you won't let your husband get away with it, why do you let your boy get away with it? Someday he's going to have to marry some woman and know how to do something besides play Nintendo. One of the things he needs to learn to do is talk. Well, I'm going to get to that in a minute, but that's still pretty good preaching right there. Laziness. Laziness. The greatest reason why we are not what we ought to be is not because of the color of our skin, because we were born to a lower economic status in life. It matters not where you started out. Through hard work and perseverance, you can become anything you want to become. It matters not you weren't born to a two-family home, a two-parent home. It doesn't matter where you started. Through hard work and diligence, you can raise the standard of your life. Feel good about yourself. Have confidence before God and security before others. Bible said, when I've done everything I can to stand, stand with confidence. Stand with assurance. I don't know when he's coming, but he's coming. He's never late. He's always right on time.
Tinkerbell's magic wand. I'm a grandpa, can you tell? Nothing depletes your self-confidence like in feeling insecure before God and other people. Can I tell you every single bad decision that's ever happened in my life, you can trace back to insecurity. Those who hurt me, who have done the most damage in my life, they were not evil. But they were insecure. The motive why they did it when they did it was not because they were evil. The deed looks evil from my standpoint, from my vantage point, when I view the crime scene of what they did to me, what they did to my family, it was evil. But can I tell you, it really wasn't evil. It was insecurity. But can I tell you every bad decision that I've ever been the father of? Can I tell you every bad decision that's ever originated in my life and with my hands? Insecurity was the producer of. I've prostituted and sold out my unique personality and gifts and calling, trying to get the affirmation of people who didn't even know I was alive. Why did I do it? Because I was insecure. It's insecurity why young boys go out and they cover themselves with tattoos thinking it's going to suddenly make them cool. It's insecurity that makes you go out and pump chemicals into your veins and body to get you high so you can run with a certain group and fit in with a certain group, even though you know it could kill you. But the reason that we did it, the reason that they're doing it is not because they're evil or stupid. They're just... The reason young girls who know better jump in the back seat of a car and let a boy that they know doesn't even really like them violate them and abuse them. Because they're insecure. Every bad decision that I have ever made in my life, outside of just being stupid, you know, but most of the really bad ones was insecurity. So how can I hate those who have hurt me when it was their insecurity that made them hurt me? when I understand there are people that are in my life that I've hurt just as deeply. And I wasn't evil either. Problem with insecurity is it exaggerates your response to both the real and perceived dangers. Instead of using a kind word to correct your child, you scream and yell and you beat them. You ever seen a parent in public over-respond to a child that's acting up? Because they don't want people to think that they're not a good parent. And so they literally beat the kid and destroy its self-confidence. Why is the parent doing that? They're not evil. How many have ever beat your kids out of insecurity? Well, the rest of you are liars. How many have ever received a beating because your parents were insecure? Our public image is one of the biggest things, how people view us, especially in men. And we're going to get to it in a little bit, but insecurity in women has to do with performance, their looks, their performance. Insecurity in men has to do with our image. We can't ever let people think we don't have it all together. Sir, you're a work in progress. Okay? You don't have it all together because I don't have it together. The oldest man in this building don't have it together, so we know you don't have it together. Okay, quit being insecure and destroying lives and destroying worlds and destroying reputations and destroying relationships. We're all works in progress. Ding. Let's go back to our text. Solomon's insecurity. Solomon's insecurity was based upon his own sinful practice. Shame is the father of all insecurity. My private life must always mirror my public profession. Solomon, we know what Solomon's many wives had turned his heart away from God, but they didn't know that in Israel. He still maintained the image, the facade of piety. But in private, he did not practice what he preached in public. And any time I live a lie, I'm insecure with God, I'm insecure with others, and I'm insecure with myself. I want to ask every single man, what do you do with this thing right here? 90% of most of your insecurities has to do with what you do with right here. I must always practice in private what I preach in public. I'm with Verizon Wireless, which means I pay them $2,500 a year for their service. Too much. But with my travel, they have the greatest net, and so there we are. When you buy that phone, it comes unfiltered. The internet comes unfiltered. You can go to any garbage can you want to. They have three security settings that the administrator of the account can set up. You can call Verizon and say, I am the administrator, and I want these phones set to PG, R, or open toilet. And every phone comes open toilet. I want to ask you, why does anybody in this room need open toilet? I want to know, why does any man in here need an open toilet? Why does any woman need an open toilet? Why do your children need an unfiltered, uncontrolled open toilet? Remember a lot of those things that came out a number of years ago had to do with computer safety, or like Watchdog and Be Safe. There are all these like programs you put on your computer, but they slowed it down so slow that it didn't work. So you waited like a week, and you're still waiting for the first program that you wanted to download, so you deleted it and went back to just normal. Well, this has to do with them. It don't slow your phone down. There's not any person in here who needs an open toilet. Today I'm strong. Today my faith is strong. But I'm trying to be honest with you, I travel for the greatest struggle of my life is loneliness. I was only in my own bed 57 nights last year. I'm not always strong. So I put safeguards on my phone because I don't want to go someplace where I shouldn't be and then try to get up and preach and be insecure with God and be insecure with myself. I've got to live in private when I preach in public. My wife has access to every single thing on my phone. My wife has access to every single account on my phone. We haven't had a problem, is there? I'm just telling you, why would you set yourself up to fail? than be insecure with God and be insecure with yourself. One of the greatest problems with security, insecurity in relationships, marital relationships, any place there's pornography, there's insecurity. Insecure with your wife, it's not her fault, sir. And this ain't what Sister Johnson talked to me about, okay? I just want to make sure I clear the deck. This is not what she talked to me about. I'm just talking to you. In my travel and in my dealing, you know how many, it's something like, I gave you the statistic the other, millennials, it's something like 4 to 20 hours a week on the average millennial spend on a computer looking at pornography. How are you going to have a conscience void of offense toward God? How are you going to have faith in God when you pray? How are you going to have confidence you can be everything God's called you to be when you're slipping around and living a lie? Live in private what you preach in public. When I do not live in private what I preach in public, it makes me insecure with everybody in the kingdom. Instead of you viewing people in your world as somebody here to help me, you now view them as a threat. Solomon found Rehoboam, and he was a man of quality. He was a man of ability. He was a man you could give a tough job to, and he could do it. But insecurity in Solomon's life made him now look at people that were in the kingdom, that were sent there to help him build what God wanted him to build and do what God had called him to do. Now no longer is that boy an asset. He's a threat, and he has to be killed. Ever had a preacher try to kill you? Insecurity. Anybody here ever had a boss try to kill you? Insecurity. Anybody here ever had an ex-loved one try to kill you? Insecurity. Mark it down. When I begin to try to destroy the lives of people around me, and my judgment is out of balance, and my judgment isn't fair, and those who look at it from a distance are like, where did that rage come from? Mark it down. Insecurity. Sin separates man from God, and it separates man from one another. In the garden, it was shame and not sin that caused Adam and Eve to hide from God and caused Adam and Eve to hide from one another. We preach about the curse of sin. I've yet to hear one preacher preach about the curse of shame. It was not sin that had Eve hiding from God and hiding from Adam. It was shame. She said, I was afraid and I hid myself. I was ashamed and I hid myself. It was not sin that separated Adam from God and separated Adam from Eve. It was shame. They were naked and they knew no shame. That wasn't just talking about physical nakedness. There was no secrets between them. There were none of these competitive games that husbands and wives play. They were emotionally naked with one another. And every relationship since then has been marked by shame. The greatest struggle every marriage in this place struggles with right now tonight is shame. Nakedness has nothing to do with shame. The pornography industry is full of naked people. That's not intimacy. Intimacy is when there's no secrets. Intimacy has nothing to do with how much clothes you have on. You can be undressed and still not be intimate. Intimacy is when I become vulnerable enough with that one person who matters the most that I'm willing to quit playing games and just be real. There's not one person in this room who does not know what the blush of shame is about. We all struggle and deal with it. I told you I'm overwhelmed. So just pump a little bit up in the minute here. Just break here. Give me the next one. Rehoboam's insecurity. Rehoboam is Solomon's son. Rehoboam's insecurity comes from a promotion without an anointing. Grace is the ability to do the will of God in any situation God has called me to be in. That's my definition of grace. I know we usually use the Baptist formula, which is grace is God's unmerited favor, which is pretty good for Baptists. It's about the best they can do. But in an apostolic sense, grace is the divine enablement of the Almighty. When the gifts of the Spirit operate, they operate according to the measure of the gift of grace. How do the gifts operate? Just a normal man. He's not more spiritual. He's not wiser. He's not smarter. But in steps the gift, because there is a divine grace in his life. There's a divine enablement in his life. He begins to speak things prophetically, divinely known and perceived only in the heart and mind of God. And grace allowed him to speak it. The Apostle Paul said, I am what I am by the grace of God. Any place God sends me, before he sends me, he sends his grace in front of me. It does not matter what I'm doing or what I'm trying to do. If I'm doing what God's called me to do before he ever sent me there, he sent his grace in front of me. He didn't send me here to fail. He sent me here to succeed. Anything in life I'm doing that God's called me to do, there's divine grace in my life to accomplish it. Apostle Paul had a thorn in the flesh, which he prayed and asked God to remove for him. And God said, my grace is sufficient for thee. So whether it's divine enablement, whether it's divine empowerment, or it's divine ability to walk through rough places, everything we do not do in our own strength. We do by divine grace. Anybody ever went to the hospital bed of a dying saint and you think you went to encourage them? You think you went to speak faith in their world? By the time you walked out, you're skipping and you're like, man, I didn't pick them up, but they sure picked me up. And you talk to people at church and say, I don't know how she kept such a sweet spirit. I can. Grace. Grace allowed her to walk where she couldn't walk without it. Grace enabled him to stand in a place he could not have stood without it. But can I do that which I have not been gifted or called to do? Did you know your pastor, I love him? You know that? I love him. Did you know he's completely unqualified for what he's trying to do if grace doesn't step in and help him? How does a carnal man, I don't care how much he loves you, I don't care how smart he is, but how does a carnal man do a work of God if God doesn't enable him? The smartest man in the world can't speak one word to save your soul if God hasn't enabled and empowered him. But I'm going to tell you, the most illiterate man that's ever lived, if the anointing's on him, can stand up and speak words, and God will honor those words. So anything I do in life, I've got to do it by divine calling and by divine grace and by divine enablement. You know what qualifies him for this job? Is not his last name is Johnson. Anybody ever here seen a preacher turn the church over to his kid and his kid wasn't called? Within a few years, the place is closed. Because when I begin to do that which I'm not called to do, I don't have the security to do it the right way. And Rehoboam's insecurity forced him. A, the old counselor said, become a servant to the people and they will love you and serve you forever. Insecurity said, I ain't a servant. I'm in charge, buddy. And baby, my little finger's going to be thicker than my father's thigh. You just thought my dad was tough. Wait till you see my holiness standards. You just think my dad preached a hard message. Wait till you hear my holiness message. Or we have the altar, or we have the other ditch. Insecurity will force a man who's trying to do that which he's not called to do to steer the car of the church into the ditch of, let's let it all go. It doesn't matter. Nothing matters. It's grace. It's grace that helps a preacher keep the road right on the straight and narrow. It's grace that enables a man not to get steered into one ditch or to steer into the other, but just steer the road car right down the road. So can I do that which I'm not being gifted to do? So why would I ever try? Whatever you're trying to do in the kingdom, do what God's only gifted and called you to do. And be happy. Be happy. Be happy working for Him. Be happy doing what you're doing. The secret of getting more in God is not hating people that are above you and tearing down people around you. It's working to perfection what you already got in your hand. If you want more than what you've got, work to perfection what you've got and watch God open doors that no man can shut.
that I'm building today, the world I'm going to live in tomorrow. And I don't want to live in a world tomorrow where I've lied and slandered and elbowed and stepped over people to get what I think I need. I want only God to give me the things that are mine. And if that means I got to wait a little longer than other people, well, let me just wait. And when God opens that door, I'll be secure where I'm at. If it's mine, it's coming. If it's not mine, I don't want it, because it will curse me. Counsel of the elders was to make yourself a servant, but insecurity demanded that he always be seen as in charge.
I ask you, are you men here in charge? No, submit. Are you in charge? Anybody here had a boss that was in charge? Anybody ever here had a preacher who was in charge? Wives, don't raise your hands. Anybody ever seen a man who was in charge? I'm not in charge of nothing. I used to have a little business. It wasn't a huge business, but it's about as big as this stupid mind can handle. During the summer months, sometimes my payroll would be between $10,000 and $12,000 a week. So, this is how it is. And can I tell you, the bigger the business got, it wasn't the more I was in charge. It was the more I was responsible. And so, while the guys all worked 40 hours and had fun, I worked 70 and 80. You know why? Because I was responsible. Well, they all went on vacation, and I couldn't get a hold of them to find out where they'd left the key to the job site. I slept with the phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and was never not on call. You know why? Not because I was in charge, but because I was responsible. I didn't sleep at night when there wasn't money for payroll. You know why? Not because I was in charge. I was responsible. I used to have dirt bikes. I loved to play with my dirt bikes. I had a CR250, which I trail rode with, and then had a CR500, which would climb a tree if you were man enough to stand on it. Let me tell you what, it was a rocket. It had paddle fin on the back, and we put shark fins on the front. About an hour and a half from where I lived, it's the largest sand dunes in North America. And I can start slobbering right now just thinking about it. I used to have a little street bike. And I can tell you a funny story, but I'm going to be long anyway, so I won't. But, you know, I had this little street bike, and me and this other guy I worked with, anytime there wasn't work to do, we wanted to blow a little steam off, we'd go out riding either dirt bikes or street bikes. And one day, him and I are out in this area. It's called Hagerman Valley. It's beautiful, lush, garden, agricultural area. Got a bunch of little switchback lanes and roads, and we're out there being boys. And I was in my mid-30s, and we had those things going. And I blew by him on the straightway and turned around honking, and he's doing this number. And I turned around, and one of those hairpin corners was rapidly approaching at a high rate of speed, which had to do with the fact the bike was moving at a high rate of speed. And so I slammed those brakes on. I don't know how it happened. The bike fell over, and I'm standing on it like you do a surfboard, you know. And we are rapidly approaching a barbed wire fence. And the bike popped as it went off of the asphalt. It turned up over the barbed wire fence. Thank God I landed in a freshly plowed field. And the bike did crush me to death as it got tangled up in the barbed wire fence. And I had an epiphany. I realized I had enough money, nobody could tell me what to do. I was in charge. But I had 10 families, not counting my own, who counted on me for a paycheck. And so was I in charge or was I responsible? And I sold all my bikes. Because the bigger the business got, it wasn't the more I was in charge. Husbands, you're not in charge of your home, but you are responsible. Insecurity demands that you always put her in her place. Insecurity will demand that you always let your kids know who's in charge. going to tell you I'm not in charge of nothing. I want to ask you women, what's easier to submit to, a man who's in charge or a man with a tyrannous eye? I said, baby, I know you don't understand me, but I feel like God's talked to me about this, and this is what we're going to do. Insecurity always demands that I let people know I'm in charge. I'm the man of my house. No, you're a idiot. And you're going to break things just to prove a point, and someday you can't fix them. And then you're going to enjoy that world you're going to live in. I'm building today the world I'm going to live in tomorrow. I don't want to live in that lonely world of being in charge. I know that's in my notes, but that's all pretty good. 2 Kings, the 12th chapter, Jeroboam's insecurity. Jeroboam's insecurity was based upon the wound he received in his life. Can I just tell you, is it none of us are getting from here to eternity without a limp, a handicap, or a deficiency in our life. Sometimes you're born with it. Sometimes it's inflicted by the actions and deeds of others. Sometimes it's just life. Sometimes it's the result of sinful practices that you've committed. But none of us are getting out of this without a limp, without a hollowed out thigh, without a speech impediment. None of us are getting over to the other side perfect. We're all going to get a wound somewhere in life. Somebody's going to wound you in some area of your life. Nobody's getting out of this without a wound. And Jeroboam's insecurity was based upon the wound he received when he spent 10 years in Egypt. And Solomon was trying to kill him. He did not have it from birth. He received the wound at the hands of somebody else in church. Let's go back and remember our introduction to him. He's a man of ability. He's a man that responsibility can be given to. He's a man you can put in charge of a process, a project, a part of the kingdom. And one day he's out just minding his own business. And up comes a preacher. And the preacher's dressed in a brand new suit. And the preacher takes all of his clothes off. Aren't you glad we don't preach like that anymore? If you're not, I am. Okay? I am very glad I don't have to take my clothes off and rip them up into 12 pieces right here tonight. But that's what the preacher did. The preacher said, hey, how you doing? Starts taking his clothes off. Preacher then gets out a knife or a pair of scissors and cuts the clothes up and hands 10 pieces to Jeroboam and said, thus saith the Lord, I'm going to rend the kingdom out of Solomon's hand, and I'm giving you 10 of the tribes, and if you will follow me, and if you'll love me, and if you'll serve me, I don't care what you do, I don't care how you rule, but rule with righteousness. And if you'll rule with righteousness, I'll build you a sure house just like I built for David. And the two were alone on the road. Did you say that? They were alone. So if they were alone, who told Solomon about the encounter with God? Hey, when God speaks to you in prayer, when God speaks you out of His Word, it's not so you can run around and tell the world how spiritual you are. It's to protect you. It's so you know what God has to do. But Jeroboam's insecurity made him talk about things he should have been silent about. You know why you run your mouth about things you ought to be silent about? You know why you run other people down and you gossip and you destroy other people when you should be silent? You know, there's three ways to get the news out. Every church has one. Telephone, television, and tell a sister. You just tell the right person, buddy, we can move the news. Yeah, I promise you, if God has ever spoken to you, some of the things you need to bring about the will of God in your life, somebody else is counting on those assets for their life. And they're not going to love you because God spoke to you. They're going to hate you. So just shut your mouth. God didn't tell you to tell the world. That's some really good preaching. That's some really good preaching. So because he was so stupid, he couldn't be silent. Solomon begins to try to kill him. This becomes the wound of his life. And just like God said it would happen, God said, I'm not taking the kingdom out of Solomon's hands. I'm going to take it out of his son's hand. Just like God said it would happen, Solomon's son approaches the throne. Solomon's son sits on the throne, and he doesn't make sound judgments. And so 10 of the tribes rebel, and they call for Jeroboam, and they say, Jeroboam, just like God said, we want you to come be our king. And he's so insecure with himself that when he comes back, he says, if I let the people go back to Jerusalem to worship God, their hearts will be turned back to Rehoboam and they'll leave me. And he built golden altars and he set up idolatry worship in Israel that took, I think, like 700 years to be eradicated from the people. He introduced the people to false worship. Hey, if God promised it to me, you can't take it from me. If God gave me the job, can't nobody take it. If God gave me the promotion, can't nobody take it. If God gave me the anointing, nobody can take it. If God gave me the wife, if God gave me the family, if God gave me the business, can't nobody take it. I don't have to kill people to keep what God gave me. Jeroboam was so insecure over the wound of his life. And because of it, God cursed him and killed him. It's some pretty powerful preaching. Hey, sir, if God gave it to you, don't be insecure with it. Just live honestly. Live with integrity. Do what you know to do. Walk with integrity. Watch God protect what He gave you. Don't let God turn on you with curse. You need to trust God with the details of your story. Next slide. Most insecurities come from both our past real and perceived failures. Shame that somehow you don't measure up to yours or to other people's expectations. Did you know most shame doesn't originate with others? It originates in our own minds. And we all deal with it. We all deal with shame. Shame is the fear of disconnection. Shame is the fear that if you knew this about me, you would not view me worthy of connection. That is what shame is all about, is disconnection. The fear of being disconnected from the body. The fear of being disconnected from relationships. The problem with insecurity and shame is it becomes the lens or the filter through which we view our whole life, both past, present, and future accomplishment. It becomes the lens that we view everything with. So I've got a couple things here. I want you to make peace with your past. They say that 8 out of every 10 girls are sexually molested by the time that they're 20 years old, and most of the time by a family member. I hope that number is lower here. But I'm here to tell you there are young girls here, maybe married women here, who have been abused in your childhood. And you need to make peace with your past. Because when you don't make peace with your past, it forever becomes the driving filter of your current shame. I'm going to get ahead of myself, but you need to rewrite your definition of success to allow for the road that you've walked. You know, we preach against divorce. It's in the Bible. We preach against it. We're going to preach against it. But how many of you know it touches the lives of people? There are probably people here who deal with shame of a divorce or separation or something didn't go right in your first marriage. And if you don't change your definition of success to allow for abuse, to allow for less than a perfect life, every time you look at your life, it's never going to measure up. You've got to change your definition of success to allow for the road that you're walking down. I want to ask you, did Bathsheba take God by surprise? When David did that with Bathsheba, did God go like, oh my word, do you know how many things I promised him? Do you know, oh my word, what am I going to do with it? Oh my word. Did God know about Bathsheba when Samuel approached David and poured the oil on his head? Yes. So did God know about... Did God know about... Does he still love you? Are you still important to him? Is God's plan for your life bigger than the failure of your life? Is grace greater than... So change your definition of success to allow, in spite of this, I can be pleasing to God. In spite of this, I can be a good husband. In spite of this, I can be a good wife. In spite of this, I can be a great mother. Change your definition of success. Make peace with your past. What didn't kill me made me stronger. What didn't destroy me made me wiser. Not everybody is born with intelligence, but none of us have to die a fool. A fool is somebody who doesn't learn anything by what life puts in their way. You ever met somebody you're like, man, they're so wise? No, they've just failed a bunch in life and learned some lessons. You ever met somebody so smart they can tell you how nuclear fusion takes place, but they can't button their shirt, change a light bulb, or keep their pants zipped up? Hey, not all of us are born with intelligence, but none of us have to die a fool. Make friends with your journey. I wouldn't know what I know today if I hadn't walked where I've walked. I wouldn't love people as deeply as I love people if I hadn't walked where I've walked. Make friends with your journey. It wasn't a mistake. It wasn't an accident. God didn't lose control of the ship of my life. He knew every single aspect of my life. And he had such great confidence in me. He let me walk. Make friends with your journey. Embrace the details of your story. And here's another one. Quit comparing your life to everybody else's. God didn't call me to anybody but me. And I wish I had, I didn't come up the easy road in ministry. You hear me? I didn't come up the easy side of the mountain. I wish I had. Until I start preaching like this man. Comparing your life to everybody else. We're all unique. Your fingerprints are unique. Your DNA is unique. Your life story is unique. There's going to be somebody from every situation that's ever been presented to mankind that's going to stand before the Lord and he's going to say, well done. When people stand before him and begin to make excuses, he's going to go, come here. Tell them your story. And they're going to go silent. Because somebody's going to walk through everything you've walked through and done it successful and done it right. And it might as well be you, and it might as well be me. Quit comparing your life to somebody else's life. And lastly, embrace vulnerability. Vulnerability is your willingness to be seen. The Bible said we have this treasure in earthen vessels that the excellency of the power may be of God and not of men. You know how much time we spend posturing to the world that we're smart, or we're perfect, or we're capable? I'm here to tell you, I'm just a dirt pot. And anything good you see in me is not me, it's God. If he ever leaves me, I'm going right back to the dirt ball I was when he found me. If you see any holiness in me, it's not me. Why do we posture that we're so powerful? I don't have the ability to live like this if he doesn't call me, anoint me, and enable me. I'm not doing this by my own grace or power. It's him. Quit posturing to the world that you're strong.
That breeds insecurity.
Insecurity may contribute to the development of shyness, paranoia, social withdrawal, or alternatively, it may encourage compensatory behaviors such as arrogance, aggression, or bullying. Go. need to rewrite your definition of success. I did this last night. I'm going to skip over it because of time. You need to quit trying to answer your critics. Where would you be in life right now if you spent all that time, money, and energy doing what God had called you to do instead of trying to answer those who hate you already? How much time have you spent trying to convert them? And how many converts? Quit. Just quit. Speak to the hand. And then start being kind to yourself. Did you know you can't be kind to others until first you've learned to be kind? Number four, vulnerability is the birthplace of innovation, creativity, and change. And if I could rewrite one single chapter of my life, how many have a chapter they'd like to rewrite? None of the promises of God in my life would be fulfilled. Because God's promise was based upon me walking where I walk. How can I hate those who have tried to destroy me when if they hadn't have touched me, I would have never arrived where I'm at? Joseph said, what you meant for evil, God turned for good. How can he hate his brothers when if they hadn't have done that to him, he had never been in Egypt? And if he had never been in Egypt, he had never been in Potiphar's house. If he had never been in Potiphar's house, he had never been in prison. If he had never been in prison, he had never sat on the throne. How can I hate those who thought they were doing evil when God knows how to turn it for good? And not one of the promises of my life would be fulfilled in my life. Not one dream that I have ever dreamed. Not one ambition that I have would be fulfilled in my life if I had to walk where I'd walked. So quit trying to rewrite that chapter of your life.
Make peace with your
building today the world that I'm going to live in tomorrow. And I did this, so I'm going to move over real quick. What is intimacy? Intimacy is your willingness to be seen. Intimacy is synonymous with vulnerability. And nakedness has nothing to do with how much clothes you have on. Intimacy. Nakedness has nothing to do with intimacy. You can be naked and never be intimate. So, the Bible said they're naked and knew no shame, part of sin. Guilt is, I have sinned against you. And that's very easy to take care of. I can take care of guilt. Shame is, I'm not good enough. They're completely different. Guilt is, I'm wrong. I've done wrong. Shame is, I am wrong. I'm bad. I'm wrong. I don't measure up. Insecurity breeds isolation and the fabrication of a lonely world of isolation. It becomes a vicious cycle that feeds upon itself. Shame is the birthplace of addiction, violence, depression, eating disorders, aggression, bullying, and suicide. Shame is what makes us hide from God, our mate, and from others. Vulnerability is the birthplace of all creativity and genius. It's the birthplace of change, innovation, and the wellspring of all possibilities. Vulnerability is also the most accurate gauge we have of courage. Vulnerability is the road back to each other. It's how we have connection. How we view vulnerability in ourselves, we view it as weakness. How we view vulnerability in others, we view it as strength. Most of you understand I'm being very vulnerable here today. And you view it as strength. But how do we view vulnerability with our mate? We view it as suicide. That's why we never do it. When it's a fact, we are our own greatest critics. We are the greatest source of injury to those that we love the most. This is where Sister Johnson died. My wife has been my greatest source of insecurity. My wife, with one word, can destroy me. But can I be honest with you and tell you, I've done irreparable damage in my wife. I'm going to get to it in a second. It's on the next slide. But shame in men is completely different. And shame in men and women, it becomes a vicious cycle that feeds on itself. While I'm trying to address my shame, I'm actually driving her shame deeper. We went through a deal here. You've heard me preach about it 100 times. We're not going to talk about it, but we always do, so let's talk about it. We went through a deal. My wife lost a really nice home, a couple of them. We lost our business. I thought I'd lost my ministry. We lost every friend we had. And we just lost everything. And we went from one abusive situation to another, thinking that we were going someplace where we'd get help. And we didn't get any help. The competitive dynamic of shame drives us apart and set together. Go ahead and go to the next slide. And so, a number of years passed. God worked some miracles. I started going out preaching, evangelizing. And you know, when you evangelize, your wife has to travel with you. You can't have any problems. You know, you can't have any marital problems. You can't have any financial problems. You can't have problems with your kids. I mean, you can't be a preacher and not be perfect. You understand that, right? This is an interesting fact. Zig Ziglar, I heard him speak about preachers' wives. He said they're finding in preachers' wives some of the exact same problems they find in people that have been in extremely stressful combat fatigue type situations. The problem is preachers' wives live in a glass house where there's no chimney. So she's always got to be perfect. And it leads to a lot of these leads to a lot of psychological problems. And so my shame is, I've got to get out. We've got to go. We've got, come on. And she's having these problems. And so I would tell her things like, buck it up. If I can do this, you can do it. All you got to do is sit there and look pretty. I'm the one who's got to pretend I know how to preach. And we closed out a revival in California. We were back in Tulsa. That's where my kids are. And we were supposed to leave. This is Saturday. We're supposed to leave to start a revival the very next day. And so I'm running around getting my stuff ready. And I find my wife sitting on the floor. She had this deal. She'd carve at her body or her face. You know, she would imagine she saw a zit where I didn't think I saw a skin pore, but you know, she'd dig at it till it would bleed. And so I spent a lot of time hating the people who had damaged my life, had damaged my wife. And a wonderful mom, Johnson, let me know I was the source of my wife's pain. So what I'm preaching to you is what I've felt like the Lord talked to me about. My wife started traveling with me. She's no longer carving her face up. But we had to stop the competitive nature of driving shame. Because how shame in women and shame in men is completely different. Shame in women is all about their looks, their children, and their performance. That's the driving factor of shame in a woman. Shame in men is always about image. Don't diss me. Don't disrespect me. Don't make me look less than perfect in public. Driving. Probably the best definition I've ever heard real of a woman in shame is, there used to be this commercial in the 70s for a perfume called Angelie. And the jingle line went, I can bring the bacon home, fry it up in the pan at night, I'll never let you forget your man. And I don't know if that sold any perfume, but it probably sold a lot of antidepressants. Because there's not enough time to do all that. There's only so much woman. You know, there's only so much money. There's only so much me. And so when a woman can't meet that perfect standard that she set for herself in her own mind, it's not that there's too much to do, it's that I'm not good enough. Somehow it's me. Somehow I don't measure up. It's amazing that most girls like themselves and their bodies till they're about the age of 11. And by the time they're 18, I think it's somewhere like 80-some% hate themselves or hate their bodies. Oh no, is there any man here who's ever heard their wife or daughter say they love their body? I've never had that conversation yet either. Because it doesn't matter whether it's big or small, or we're talking about your toes or your nose. If it's big, you wish it was small. If it's small, you wish it was big. And almost every woman I know focuses in on one area of her body that she really wishes she could change. And she hates her whole self because of that. You know who the meanest people in the world are?
Working women.
They're brutal. Working women are brutal. They're just brutal. You know why they're brutal? It's because of shame. And you know what they use on each other? They beat each other up with shame. Why don't you do something with your hair? You know, even an old barn looks better if you slap a coat of paint on it. Why are you so pale? Researchers asked women, who would you rather get a compliment from, your girlfriend or your husband or significant other? And it's 90-some percent of women said they'd rather get a compliment from a girlfriend than they would from their husband or significant other. And so I want to ask every one of you women here, whose applause really matters? In the driving of shame of your life, whose applause really matters? Does it matter what the girls say, or does it matter what God says? Does it matter what your friends say, or does it matter what your husband says? Because most men are really happy where they are, and they're happy with you. I'm quit here. I'm almost done. So whose applause really matters? Whose applause really matters? Shame in men is men absolutely will never do anything in public to which could be viewed as a weakness. When a man is dealing with shame, he vents his frustration by isolation, aggression, and manipulative behavior. Sometimes he'll stay in the marriage, but he simply checks out. He will work and never come home. Sports are like 90-some percent men. You know why? It's an ultimate world where they hide from their shame. A man cave is where a man goes when he can't deal with the shame of his life. Pornography is mostly dominated by men who can't deal with the shame of their life. They're in the marriage, but they're not involved in the marriage. Silent. I'm here. I'm enduring, but I'm not involved. Computer games. Who's a computer game mostly ran by, dominated by? This is why you shouldn't let your boys play them, you hear me? Because you're teaching him to live in a private world where nobody else can go. I'm not against hunting, but hunting's another great place that men go when they've checked out a relationship. You know how I know I'm right? Because let your wife or your children try to intrude into that private world that you live in and watch you rip their heads off. The very first thing God's eye ever saw in the garden that God said was not good was a man living by himself. When God made the world, he saw it was good. When God made this, he saw it was good. And I'm halfway done and I'm quitting here. Let me see what the next slide is. Let me see if there's somewhere to stop there on a positive note. Yeah, I'm going to do this one. Yeah, I'm going to do this one. I'm going to do this. I'm going to finish this and I'll be done. I want you to say with me, we can buy together what we cannot buy by ourselves. Would you say that for me? We can buy together what we cannot buy by ourselves. If I had all of your money, you understand I could buy more with all your money than I can buy by myself. You understand that, right? Well, in a relationship, I can buy more together than we can buy by ourselves. As my last daughter walked up the aisle, three of my girls, I'm very proud of my girls, all three of my girls are married. They're married to young boys that are in church. All three wore white when they walked up the aisle. Not because it's tradition, because it really meant something. I'm very proud of my girls. Purity meant something in my home. We had rules in our home nobody else had. We went to a church, you didn't have to be chaperoned. My kids were chaperoned till the day they said I do. Because I don't trust myself, so why do I trust him? No, you're not trustworthy. You're 18. But anyway, as my last daughter got married, my wife and I were talking. We were kind of going through this empty nest syndrome. which you were the smart one and brought along one long tail cow there. You're smarter than I was. We had nothing. Now we got grandkids, so it's okay, but for a while we had nothing. And we were lamenting our loneliness, and Patty said, you know what, baby? We bought together what we couldn't buy by ourselves. You know why most marriages fail, most relationships fail? Because we're competing for money, we're competing for dominance, we're competing for shame, the control of the shame factor in the marriage. We're controlling for the emotional right to the spiritual high ground of the house. Not understanding we can buy more together than we could ever buy by ourselves. My wife and I should have never got married, ever. We were oil and water. And if it wasn't for the church, we would have divorced. I was raised in a family I'd never heard an argument ever. My wife didn't know you couldn't argue without breaking things, throwing things, and hitting things. We had no premarital counseling or we would not have got married. But we stuck it out. And now we've been able to buy things together. I'm not talking about possessions. But we've got a great marriage. My wife is my best friend. But we've bought together things we couldn't buy by ourselves. This will be my last slide and I'll be done. The greatest gift you can give yourself, your family, is to allow them and yourself to be less than perfect. What I'm preaching to you about is not a sprint, it's a journey. This one message isn't going to fix all your problems. But I want to start a dialogue. I want to start a dialogue. I want you to understand what's happening in the relationship. He's not an idiot, he's driven by shame. She's not an idiot, she's driven by shame. Shame. If we could put shame in a petri dish, like in a scientific environment, and study it, shame needs three things to exponentially grow. It needs silence, it needs judgmental behavior, and it needs secrecy. Those are the three things that we need to have for shame to exponentially grow. The second we begin to talk about it, it begins to shrink. The second it's no longer a secret, we begin to talk about it. I'm only as sick as my sickest secret. Do you know the only antidote known for shame is empathy? And anytime empathy walks in the room and you pour it on shame, it immediately dies. Empathy is me too. I understand. Neither do I condemn you. Can I tell you the second greatest source of shame in my life is the church? It's people in the church. When we sit up on our spiritual high horse and act like we've never failed, the very best friend I had growing up as a young preacher just got out of prison for inappropriate sexual contact with a minor. And I can feel the collective revulsion of horror as we all withdraw. And we want to say, well, I never. Well, you're a liar. That may not be your problem, but you have a problem. And if I had not have had the family I had, if I had not had the upbringing I had, who knows if that could have been me. In Galatians, the 6th chapter, it says, if a brother's overtaken in a fault, you that are spiritual, restore such a one in mercy, considering yourself. The mark of spirituality. I'm a holiness preacher. I ain't never backing down from holiness. I'm not backing down from standards on the platform. I believe in all that. I'm not saying that. But the mark of spirituality is not when we stand back and we judge people and say, I've never failed and I've never sinned and I've never done anything wrong. The mark of true spirituality is when you approach somebody that has fallen and you use these words, I understand. Those that are spiritual among you, restore such a one in love, considering yourself. While you're dealing with somebody else that's fallen, you acknowledge, you know what? Except for the grace of God, that could be me. Except for what God's put in my life, that could be me.
I'm not above failure. I'm not above destroying and disqualifying what God's done in my life. I want to ask you how, do you know why I think most backsliders don't come back to God?
Shame.
Don't want to have to walk in and face people.
Shame.
The religious people of Jesus' days found a woman taken in the very act of adultery. She was in the bed. They grabbed her, probably didn't let her properly clothe herself, drug her through the city, approached Jesus, not because they loved her, they wanted to prove a point. And what did they do to her? They beat her up with shame. She's unclothed, she's caught in the very act. And they said, Moses in the law commanded that this woman be stoned. What do you say? And the only person who's ever had a right to say she needed to die stooped down and began to write in the dust. And when he got done writing, he stood up and looked her in the eye and he said, Woman, where art thine thou accusers? I got it. He said, neither do I condemn thee. Empathy. Compassion. Pity. The greatest antidote for shame is when we're all willing to acknowledge we're all flawed. We're all just sinners saved by grace. And I can buy together, but I can't get by myself. I've been long, but I'm only halfway there. So I'm going to quit. Once you come back Wednesday night, we'll finish this up. It does finish on a very high note. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and give you part of what I finish on, just because I do want to finish it high. The Bible says, and ye are complete in Him, who's the head of all principality and power. Without God in my life, I'm insufficient. Without God in my life, I don't measure up. But when God walks in my life, I'm complete. I am complete in Him. With God in my life, with the enablement of grace, I'm enough of a man to be a husband. Because I'm complete in Him. There's nothing to be ashamed of. With God in your life, ladies, you're enough of a woman to be a mother, to be a wife, to be whatever you've been called to be. Without God in your life, you're in trouble. But with God in your life, I'm enough. Would you say that? Every woman say, I'm enough. Just like, come on, I'm enough. Just like I am, I'm enough. I don't need surgical enhancement. I don't need to change this or to change that. Just like I am. Enough. I want every one of you young people to know, just like you are, you're enough. You girls, you're enough. You don't have to prostitute your unique calling, unique gifting to get the affirmation and blessing of somebody who doesn't matter. Just like you are, you're enough. You don't need a better car. You don't need a better house. You don't need the latest shoe. You don't need the latest dress. Just like you are. Don't need the applause of the world. Don't need the accolades of the world. With God in your life, just like you are, I am. As we stand. Probably not really what you expected, but God has talked to every single person in this house tonight. I know you usually split up. Men on one side, women on the other. But I want you to stay together. If you want to come up front and pray together, you can. If you want to pray in your pew, you can. Sometime between tonight and Wednesday night, when it's just you and that one that means the most in life,
want you to lay your hands on them. I want you to tell them, just like you are, baby, you're enough. I'm not a real preacher because I'm not here long enough. But Jacob from birth was promised the blessing of God. And no time ever in Jacob's life until he was dying did he ever bless or affirm anybody. On a regular basis, we need to bless and affirm the people that matter the most in life. Husbands, you need to bless and affirm your wife. Wives, you need to bless and affirm your husband. Parents, you need to bless and affirm your children. Don't let shame drive you apart. I'm done. Let's find a place to pray. God bless you. Thank you for being so attentive.
Amen. If you would, I want you to just come to the front. Brother Myers talked to me about shame, and he spoke with me very briefly on it. And when he got to talking about shame, and that's all we talked about, matter of fact, we just talked about shame. I am fiercely protective of you. But I'm a smart man, and I know that shame has touched every life in here somewhere, somehow. Whether it be with a divorce, whether you, even something as simple as the white dress, the shame that would go with it, because of a mistake, when you weren't in a place that you should be. And I realize that even in my life, there's areas, and it's always a journey that you're on. You're never going to get there. You'll always keep trying to get there until you get to heaven. Until the day you get to heaven, you're never going to have it all together. You're never going to be perfect. You're never going to be where you can quit trying and quit praying and quit talking to God and telling God, God, you know this area. You know what I'm dealing with. Never are you ever going to get, long as you've got the skin on. I've always said that. Long as you've got skin on. Long as you flesh. There's going to be shame somewhere. Brother Myers touched even areas of my life, and I just say, oh, the shame. What was I thinking? Why? Scars are there, some that nobody even knows. Nobody has any idea. I know it's discussed, he's mentioned pornography. That doesn't mean that he's picking up on things that pornography, he's just, those are areas and those are things, but it's prevalent in the world we're in today. And if you don't guard yourself, if you're not careful, you'll be on a computer and so that's what preaching is for. That's why it's the watchman on the wall, and that's why it's saying, hey, guard yourself, arm yourself, be careful, be aware, because that's what God puts the man behind the pulpit for, because he don't want you to be hurt. He don't want you to have to go through shame. Unless they warn you, you will, because left alone, we will self-destruct. Left alone, brethren, we will self-destruct. If you don't have a walk with God, if you don't have a prayer life, hey, you'll deal with shame, because you're not strong enough on your own. You are not man enough. I don't care if you're as big as Brother Myers, you are not tough enough on your own to do it on your own. And so I have no doubt with certainty. I know there's areas of my life that I'm ashamed of, and it hinders you, it stops you, and I don't want to leave it right here. I too want him to finish it to where we leave it on a high note. And that's why he said it was a two-part in the beginning, and it has to have another service and another time and opportunity. But before we close, I know the denominational world, they out there, they say, you know, before we end the service, you ever heard Joel Osteen, before we We always want to give an altar call, and if you'll just accept Christ, I don't want to make it even sound like that, but before we leave this place, I want God, because every one of you that in His preaching last night and then tonight, every one of you when He's preaching it, because I know I did, because God quickens you and God touches you. When He hit an area or He said something, you thought of it. I know you did. I see your faces. You thought of it. You come back. That's what He's talking about. And the shame, the incident was fresh in your mind. The moment was fresh in your mind all over again. And so before we leave here, I want God to just reach down and touch every one of you. We don't have time because of school, because of work. We're not going to do an altar call in line and pray for every one of you. We've done that before. But I want you to, right where you are, just as they play and sing softly, we're going to ask God, God, would you, like Brother Myers just said, make peace. God, give us peace. And these areas that God brought to our attention through the preaching of the Word, these areas, these incidents, these moments, these failures and mistakes and offenses, these things are just life and what's happened in our life and things we've went through where it brings shame to us that nobody but you and God know about. And as they sing this, I want you to pray, and we're going to ask God to touch you. And where there's shame, I want God to give you peace, because He can do it. It doesn't take long. He can just with one touch before you leave here, God can, He can take away that shame and He can give you peace. Why don't you just lift your hands and let's ask God to touch us right now. God, before we close tonight through the preaching of the Word.